Next up on Youth Beat Radio, join me, Lindsay Hirsch, in discovering all of the tradition and the history that encompass our modern Thanksgiving. You may be surprised to learn where some of our traditions come from and where some of our modern food originates from. Learn what the original pilgrims would have eaten on their first Thanksgiving, and learn when Thanksgiving actually became a national holiday. In addition to that, we'll hand you some cold facts on turkey, and we'll also talk about alternatives to Black Friday shopping. Tune in to listen. We'll start right after this break.
You hear that fiddle? Why is there so much joy, so much sorrow, so much laughter, so many tears in that one little fiddle? Why? Because it's trying to tell you a story about people.
Papas, mamas, daughters, sons-in-law, a horse.
A horse. A disaster on four legs.
Nevertheless, a horse. And neighbors, people who lived in the old country in a shtetl, a little town.
A town, a village.
A village. A little speck of mud in the middle of nowhere with nothing.
Nothing but people.
People with tradition.
Tradition! 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 Tradition!
Traditions. Since first man walked erect, the human race has been one with a keen eye for tradition and ceremony of any kind. Every culture has its own form of rituals and rites, along with its celebrations. In America, we find tradition in baseball, in apple pie, and above all else, in Thanksgiving. From our earliest school years, we have been told the story of the Mayflower, its pilgrims, and the Indians who sat down together to share that first harvest in the New World. But nearly 400 years of time has created an odd window from which to view the events of that very first Thanksgiving, and some of what we commonly believe is a very vague shadow of its original truth. In this show, we aim to tackle the most common myths associated with the first Thanksgiving and to bring the truth to the surface. So get comfy, because our journey starts 396 years ago, on the three-masted, wooden-hulled ship that will forever linger in our minds as the Mayflower. The date is September 16th, 1620. The harbor in Plymouth, England, is unusually crowded, filled with a wide assortment of individuals from sailors to merchants to common people. They are gathered to say a final goodbye to the 102 people standing above them, ready to set sail for the distant shores of America and a new life. The entire human cargo is comprised of 50 men, 19 women, 14 young adults, and 19 children. Most hope to escape religious persecution and to be able to live in peace with their beliefs. Originally called separatists, they are the people that we today know as the Pilgrims. Most of this probably sounds familiar to you, but what may not sound familiar is that not everybody aboard was sailing away from persecution. While nearly half of the cargo was separatists, a handful of passengers merely sympathized with them or are going for adventure. The New World is a promising place for trappers and excitement. The remaining men are crew members. Regardless, as she casts off from her port, the Mayflower is a ship carrying the hopes and dreams of many people. Only time will tell if she can stand up to them.
Thank you.
For several weeks, the Mayflower meets nothing but smooth waters and favorable winds. While seasickness, cramped quarters, and poor hygiene are ever present, the first half of the pilgrim's journey is relatively worry-free. But come October, the sea turns its full wrath on the 25-foot-wide, 106-foot-long vessel. Nasty storms force the crew to furl all of the sails, leaving the ship to the mercy of the waves and wind, which knock them nearly 500 miles off course. Finally, on November 9th, a lookout spots land. 66 days after their departure, the pilgrims get their first glimpse at coastline. Originally, Captain Miles Standish tries to sail his ship further south, hoping to find the mouth of the Hudson River, where the pilgrims hope to establish a plantation. However, after some nasty encounters which nearly sink the ship, they turn north again and dock in the area that will one day be known as Cape Cod. Laying anchor in what they dub Provincetown Harbor, a crew of men is sent ashore to survey for good land. While they are gone, other inhabitants take to washing clothes for the first time in 2 months, and to smoking out the ship, ridding it of the foul odor of seasickness and uncleansed bodies. Amazingly, only one person has died in the crossing, William Button. And with a baby being born, and aptly named Oceanus Hopkins, the passenger count remains at 102. But the hard times have just begun. Winter is approaching, and there is little food left and no shelter. Although the settlers finally dock permanently in Plymouth, they must build all of their housing from the ground up. The long period of stagnation, poor nutrition, and disease aboard the ship has made many of the travelers sick, and at times only 7 adults are available to work. They work hard to erect a meeting house and begin on several homes, hoping to beat the imminent New England cold. The snow, however, comes quickly, and these settlers discover that winter in New England is far fiercer than those across the ocean. The meeting house turns into a hospital as the freezing temperatures combine with sickness and hunger. That winter sees the death of exactly half of the original passengers. 51 souls, aged from just 4 upwards, are given proper burials on shore. Not all of their remains have been found. However, a memorial at Plymouth mourns and commemorates their struggles. Among the dead are Mary Moore, aged 4, William Mullins, and Rose Standish, the captain's wife. Thank you. As spring blooms in Massachusetts, the weary and hope-starved settlers talk of returning to England. Though the ground they live on is cleared and ready for planting, they know they cannot survive a bad harvest. Here, however, is where their fortune begins to turn. The thaw has brought them a visitor, a Pawtuxet man named Tisquantum. Called Squanto by the English, Tisquantum comes to offer his service as translator for the Wampanoag Confederacy. As a young boy, he had been captured by the English and sold into slavery. Over time, he was taught to read, write, and speak English. Though he eventually managed to sail home again, he was met with a devastating scene. His home, the very land that the pilgrims now lived on, had been wiped out by disease. He was the last remaining Pawtuxet. A neighboring tribe of Wampanoag kindly took him in, as the Pawtuxet people had been part of the Wampanoag Confederacy. Tisquantum introduces the settlers to Osamequin, who has held the title Massasoit Sachem, or head of the Wampanoag Confederacy. Osamequin also spoke fluent English, and the settlers were impressed with the formal speaking style both he and Tisquantum used. Osamequin and his people traded freely with the settlers and taught them how to farm their new land. It is thanks to them that the first harvest is so bountiful, and they are invited to celebrate their success with the New England friends.
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we are sub sorrow with a poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. There's a song. Sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many days have you lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more. While we seek mirth and beauty and music bright and gay, there are frail forms fainting by the door. Though their voices are silent, their haunting looks will say, oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song, sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many days have you lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more.
On a date now lost to history, 90 Wampanoag men, women, and children join the 51 settlers to celebrate the first success of the New World. Though there is only one written account surviving, it reveals a great deal. Contrary to popular belief, the first Thanksgiving would never have been called Thanksgiving. To the attendants, it was only a celebratory party with no special name. It also lasted 3 days, complete with games, food, and laughter. Speaking of food, you'll also be surprised to find out that a great deal of our modern Thanksgiving table was not on the 1620s menu. Although turkeys did roam the woods, we only have evidence of duck being served. Along with waterfowl, the Wampanoag brought along 5 deer to add to the table, and there was certainly no stuffing to go with any of them. Potatoes, cranberry sauce, and pumpkin pie would all have been missing as well. Potatoes weren't brought to North America until much later, and cranberries were eaten raw, not stewed into a sauce. Desserts probably would have been maple sugar and berries. So where, you're asking me, did all of our modern traditions come from? Well, to answer that, we'll need to jump forward a bit. Sarah Josepha Buell was born October 24, 1788, to a world with no scheduled Thanksgiving. Though George Washington had proclaimed several days to give thanks over the course of the American Revolution, he never solidified them into a single holiday. Thanksgivings were celebrated in a handful of states on a handful of days, and they acted more as a day of prayer than festivities. In the South, these days were virtually unheard of. In 1846, Sarah began a 17-year-long journey to get Thanksgiving nationalized. Though she campaigned to five presidents, only one, Abraham Lincoln, took her seriously. After the turmoil of the Civil War, President Lincoln thought that a day of unity might do the still angry country some good. So, on October 20th, 1864, Lincoln set the last Thursday of November aside for a national Thanksgiving, much to the delight of schoolchildren everywhere. To help in the celebration of her long-awaited holiday, Hale published many of the recipes that we count today as Thanksgiving staples, including turkey, stuffing, and cranberry sauce. Let's close the history book now and talk turkey. 88% of households count turkey as a staple Thanksgiving food, with nearly 46 million of the bird being consumed in a single day. But these turkeys have been domesticated, and are only one of two native birds to have been so. The other is the Muscovy duck. Wild turkeys still roam freely across America, and probably have for several thousand years according to fossil records. These birds live in harems, with the single male tom presiding over a group of female hens. Only toms have the iconic gobble hanging from their beaks, as well as a glorious fan of 18 tail feathers. Although they look fat and waddly, these birds have an impressive speed. They can run at 25 miles per hour and fly at 50 miles per hour, making it easy for them to keep up with you all the way to grandmother's house. Though I wouldn't ask them inside.
Over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house we go. The horse knows the way to carry the sleigh through white and drifted snow. Over the river and through the woods, oh, how the wind does blow. It stings the toes and bites the nose as over the ground we go. Everybody now.
Over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house we go. The horse knows the way to carry the sleigh through white and drifted snow. Over the river and through the woods, oh, how the wind does blow. It stings the toes and bites the nose as over the ground we go.
Slow, it is so hard to wait. Over the river and through the woods, now grandmother's cat I spy. Hooray for the fun, is a pudding done? Hooray for the pumpkin pie.
Hooray for the fun, is a pudding done? Hooray for the pumpkin pie. Hooray!
Another symbol of Thanksgiving, the cornucopia, finds its roots in, of all things, Greek legend. When the soon-to-be king of the gods, Zeus, was born, he was immediately hidden from his father, who had eaten all of his children to prevent them from usurping his throne. Raised in a cave on Mount Ida, young Zeus was fostered by the nourishing Amalthea, a goddess who was also a goat. One day, while drinking her milk, Zeus reached up and tugged one of Amalthea's horns, accidentally breaking it off with his incredible strength. When he put it in his mouth, like most children would, he found out that it provided an endless source of nourishment. And so the cornucopia was born. But today we just use a horn-shaped basket. Amalthea doesn't really take kindly to non-deities breaking off her body parts and using them as a centerpiece. And neither do normal goats, actually. Of course, we couldn't possibly talk about Thanksgiving without mentioning Black Friday. Well, actually, we could. And we will! Instead of talking about hackled store clerks and soccer moms catfighting over the last Princess Sparkles fairy doll, YouthBeat has decided to talk about Buy Nothing Day. What is Buy Nothing Day, you ask? Excellent question. Depending on where you live, Buy Nothing Day will occur either the Friday or the Saturday after Thanksgiving. The entire idea is to pass a day without spending a penny. No Starbucks, no groceries, no Christmas shopping. During a season that seems to be overrun with consumerism, Buy Nothing Day aims to remind people that there is more to the holidays than low, low prices on Wheeze and peppermint-flavored coffee. Instead, spend the days after Thanksgiving with your family. You know, giving thanks and being grateful for the fact that you live in a country wealthy enough to be able to have a Black Friday. Feel like you can't go a few days without diving into the Christmas shopping? Then try Small Business Saturday. Instead of hitting up malls and huge chain stores, try shopping at local businesses. Instead of a big coffee joint, try the mom and pop shop down the street. Want toys for your kids? Stores like Larson's on West Lane, Big Fun on North High, and any number of small shops in the Short North provide quality toys that your kids will love. Got a bookworm? The Book Loft in German Village, the Village Bookshop on West Dublin Granville Road, and Cover to Cover on North High Street, and many others have a huge selection of books, often at lower prices than the bigger bookstores. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of Youth Beat Radio. We hope you tune in next week, and we hope you tune in for our Christmas special. Have a happy Thanksgiving and enjoy your turkey! This week's music is thanks to Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the music and lyrics respectively for Fiddler on the Roof, Joseph Brackett, who wrote Simple Gifts, and the Rydell Fiddles version of Hector the Hero. Youth Beat Radio would like to take this time to thank the Puffin Foundation West, the Ohio State Extension's program, and our private donors. Be sure to check out our Facebook, Twitter, and our website, youthbeat.osu.edu.